sense. This is a study that really looks at what we can learn from examining the lived experience of women who are pregnant and in the first 2 years postpartum who all are experiencing intimate partner violence in their lives. I'd like to acknowledge all of my authors, two of which are in the audience today. These authors come from the University of Virginia, Johns Hopkins University, and George Mason University. And I have no disclosures. This parent study for this qualitative analysis is the Domestic Violence Home Visitation Study, which is also known as DOVE. It was a randomized control trial of 239 women who were experiencing perinatal intimate partner violence. And we were evaluating a home visit intervention during pregnancy. And we collected data from these women at baseline, and then we went back four more times postpartum, and we conducted in-depth interviews and did quantitative analysis as well, or did quantitative measures at those times. So we went about this study by taking the most rural zip codes by census data and took the first 10 women in those zip codes who had completed data collection at all points. The group was in the middle of their childbearing years. They were largely not legally bound to their partners. 50% of them had had some college education. Most of them were experiencing their first pregnancy. Most of them were white. This was conducted in the Midwestern United States. And 70% of them had Edinburgh postpartum depression scale scores of 13 or greater, which is consistent with signs and symptoms of postpartum depression. So the approach that we took to this analysis was a Heideggerian phenomenological approach of iterative analysis of these five different in-depth interviews from each participant. There were four people doing the coding, and we met very, very frequently as we went through all of these interviews and established the trustworthiness and saturation of our themes by looking both within each participant across all the time points and looking at the between subject comparisons of the themes that were emerging from the coded data. We had an overarching theme that emerged from this data that we call negotiating peril. And there were four sub-themes within this: the unstable environment, purposive calibration, the primacy of motherhood, and numb acceptance. And I want to explain a little bit about what each of those consisted of. We call this overarching theme negotiating peril because these women, it was amazing as you looked at over 2.5 years of these women's lives, how they were continuously navigating perilous circumstances. It was like they were in boats on very rough sea and constantly having to make small shifts or large shifts to keep themselves and their family intact and upright. And each and every one of them had a sense of what an ideal family life should look like. And it was not all the same ideal, but each one had an ideal in their head. And across the board, it completely contradicted their reality. And yet this was a point that they were all in search of. And they were navigating these circumstances, trying to figure out their own personal autonomy. They were dealing with substance abuse issues and mental health issues in their families and in community environments. There was all sorts of insecurity around food, housing, and jobs. The structural violence of the systems and agencies that were in place to help them, and they were exposed to violence. They were in constant danger. So the sub-theme of unstable environment refers to environments in which the ability to secure basic human needs such as shelter, food, affection, and validation is constantly threatened. And this is something that had many, many layers to it. And I want to give you just one quote from one of our women who was 6 months postpartum when she was asked about, we'd heard a rumor that her boyfriend had lost his job. And this is what she said. "He didn't lose his job yet. He switched jobs. The roofing company shut down, so he had no idea for or no job for a while. I quit KFC where I was working at. I started babysitting full-time for my aunt down the road, and then I had to stop babysitting for her because he'd gotten to the point where he was breaking things in the house with the kids in the house because he was mad at me over things. So there are many layers to that job insecurity. Another woman who was having problems, she was really wanting to engage on some level with the agencies designed to help her, the Department of Family Services, who was constantly pressuring her to leave her partner. And she was very frustrated because the one thing that she really thought a government agency ought to provide for her was childcare. She said, "I wanted to know if they could help me with babysitting, because if I got rid of him and didn't have a babysitter, I asked for help, and, well, Mrs. W., you make a lot of money. You make around $2,000 a month. You're damn right, without taxes, I bring maybe $1,400, $1,500 home a month, and it's all gone because my bills. You just don't have any money." So there was no way she could get rid of her abuser because she didn't have access to other child care. The second sub-theme, purposive calibration, really talks about the brilliance that these women exhibit as they are constantly adapting for survival within their abusive relationships. They would try to control the abusive behavior, sometimes triggering the violence and sometimes avoiding the triggers according to what they needed to do to keep everything on an even keel. And that even keel, or normal, is something that they were defining and redefining throughout the 2.5 year period in order to achieve some sort of equilibrium in their environment. So this young woman was asked about safety planning, and she said, "Oh, I never felt really unsafe with him, so I haven't ever tried anything to keep myself safe. When he gets mad, I take a few steps back if I know that he's gonna, like the chair incident, I seen him pick up that chair and I said, okay, and move back a little bit. He didn't throw it at me. So I just try to make sure when I know he's gonna get mad about something, you get as far away back as you can." The third sub-theme is the primacy of motherhood. These women were all exhibiting what we considered to be hyper-vigilant behaviors towards their children. They wanted to protect their children and do the very best that they could to be an outstanding mother for their children, and they derived a lot of their sense of self-worth from this. One woman said, "I want him to know I'm not going anywhere at all, that I will always love him and I'm always here for him. I don't want him to feel that he has nobody like I did. I don't want my son going through any of that at all. That's what I want, to be a good mom and to take care of him like I need to." And we heard echoes of this in every single interview. But finally, these women all exhibited some numb acceptance as well, accepting the abuse as inevitable and constantly presenting a protective front for the children that involved a sort of normalization and numbing of themselves to the violence that they were experiencing. There was one woman at 24 months who had managed to distance herself from her abuser and had these words to say about it. She said, "An abuser could knock a person down so much that they feel like they're nothing. Like, that's how I felt. I was nothing. I had no self-respect, no dignity, no pride. I mean, when it came to fixing my hair, changing my clothes, putting on my makeup, I wouldn't fix myself up. So that's what abusers have to do. They knock you down so much that you feel like you have nowhere else to go. And an abuser will knock you down and hit you and punch you and kick you and call you a bunch of names. 5 minutes later, it'll be like, 'Oh, I love you. I'm so sorry.'" So all of this begs the question of, when we examine what these women have to say to us, we're all wondering, as public health professionals, why do our interventions, we all think our interventions should lead to the woman leaving her abuser. Why don't these interventions work? Well, one of the things that really came through in our data was the ambivalence and the sense of disenfranchisement that women felt towards the agencies that we have and the community resources that we've designed to help them. The other thing we saw was how the cumulative trauma that these women have experienced, many of it being in their family system from their childhood, has led them to live adult lives that are greatly void of intimacy with other adults. And they are, as a result, they desensitize themselves to everything that they're feeling around them. And they don't react to potential violence the way that people who are not living in violent surroundings would. And they meet their intimacy needs through their role as mothers, which provides for their intimacy needs, and their sense of self-worth is enhanced in that role. It was amazing to see how these women, who in many cases you'd look at their lives from the outside and think you see this highly dysfunctional behavior. They're making choices again and again that don't make sense to the public health professionals who were trying to help them. But once you got into these in-depth interviews and learned about what they were thinking at the time that they stole someone's WIC card or did other kinds of things that seemed really inappropriate, you'd understand that they were making the best decision they could with the resources they had available to them in the short term. And that this was part of how they negotiated the peril in their lives. Another thing that came through in the data, as we looked over time at these women's interviews, they would disclose abuse in the later interviews that they had all, in the quantitative measure at baseline, they had screened in that we knew that they had violence in their intimate lives. But what we didn't know was the extent of that violence, and they wouldn't disclose that necessarily during the pregnancy or in the early months postpartum. But as they got to know their researchers who were working with them, they would disclose that abuse over time at 12 months and 24 months. So the longer we were with them, the more explicit the descriptions of the violence in their lives became. So what do we conclude from the results of this study? Well, one of the things that we've concluded is that we need to approach our interventions with the goal of creating safer family environments. That the goal is not to get the woman out of the situation, it's to create a safer family environment that she can be comfortable in and her children can be safe in. We clearly see how complex and dangerous their circumstances are, and have come to recognize that for this cohort of women, the violence was ubiquitous and it was built into the system. And perhaps the most helpful thing that we saw the nurse home visitors doing who were engaged in the intervention with the women, what they were doing was deconstructing normal for these women. When the women live in an environment, they've grown up around violence, their neighbors are also engaged in very violent behaviors, that they didn't have a sense. Some of them would say to us, well, I didn't know that if somebody was kicking me and hitting me or throwing things at me all the time, that meant I was experiencing violence. And so this was actually an intervention, the nurses deconstructing normal for them. Our research team believes we need to continue this research to look at the lived experience of urban women, because these were very rural women. And we also have come to understand that our research was driven by our own standpoint, and that we really need to start talking to these women about what they need and understanding from their perspective of that sort of skewed normal space how we can help them move to a different place in a way that helps them integrate their ideal family life that they have as a narrative that they're always striving for. How do we help them get closer to that path? So at this point, I'd like to thank the entire Dove team at the University of Missouri, Johns Hopkins University, and University of Virginia, who these are the folks who collected the data and have helped analyze it, and our funders, the National Institute of Nursing Research, and the research participants themselves, who gave a lot of their time to this study. And I don't think we actually reached a conclusion about whether we take questions now or later.
It's up to you.
I'm happy to take questions now. Thank you so much for being here and for your attention. Yes. I would say that there were many different precautions taken. In many cases, I don't believe that the partner knew she was participating in the research. Sometimes these interviews would take place in the researcher's car at a fast food restaurant that was, you know, 15, 20, 30 miles from the person's house. So sometimes they occurred at the place of employment. There was one particular day that I know a researcher arrived at a home and the grandmother of the baby met the researcher at the door and said, "This is not a good time, go away." And the researcher left quickly and not taking her eyes off the house while she went back to her car. So It was always a dynamic situation that we were always aware of, the safety issues. And even also trying to, we tried as much as possible to conduct these interviews in cars and not in people's homes. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much.